Good afternoon. You are tuned to KTOO. The time is about 3 o'clock, and this is the Juno Afternoon for Tuesday, November 19th. My name is Martha Moore. Coming up in today's program, we'll find out about the theater at Latitude 58's production of Seussical. Tom Bryce will focus on Operation Christmas Child. We'll celebrate World Toilet Day with guest Sue Belita. We'll get an update on Perseverance Theater's current main stage performance of Treasure Island. And we'll learn about Thunder Mountain High School's AVID program with teacher Annie James. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. The forecast today is calling for mostly cloudy, scattered snow showers, developing highs around 16.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The governor of Kansas has publicly apologized to Native people for past mistreatments at Indian boarding schools. A proclamation by the governor was presented at Haskell Indian Nations University last week in Lawrence. The school opened in the 1800s as an industrial training school and evolved into today's tribal college. Rhonda Lavaldo reports.
Sam Brownback made a proclamation on behalf of the state apologizing for the policies enacted by boarding schools.
Expresses deep remorse for the ramifications of former ill-conceived assimilation policies and apologizes on behalf of the people of Kansas to all Native peoples for the hardships, maltreatment, and deaths of the children that attended Haskell.
Haskell Student Senate President Stacy Kay says she thought his proclamation was a step in the right direction.
Politics is like a give-and-take, love-hate relationship, and so I think this is probably just one of his ways to try to regain maybe a little bit of trust or faith within the Native community.
The Healing and Restoration event also showed a documentary called We Were Children that Brownback watched as well. For National Native News, I'm Rhonda Lavaldo.
Tribes on a U.S. reservation have received a six-figure grant from a foreign country to upgrade a rural water system. The money comes from Turkey's international agency, TIKA, which delivers grants around the world. Jacob Resnick has more from Istanbul.
$200,000 has been awarded to the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation, southeast of Portland, Oregon. Turkey's ambassador to the United States, Namik Tan, recently hosted a reception in Washington, D.C., where Warm Springs Chief Joseph Moses accepted the donation. The grant will go towards a water tank at an elementary school that serves more than 700 students on the reservation. And here in Turkey, newspapers have made much of the grant, in which Turkey, a nation of 76 million people, was giving money to the United States. It's usually the other way around. The Turkic people of Eurasia trace their ancestry to nomads of the Central Asian steppe. Some Turks believe that today's North American natives originally migrated over a land bridge and point to some linguistic and cultural similarities, but this theory remains controversial. The tribal representatives have expressed gratitude for helping the project, which is expected to be completed next fall. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick in Istanbul, Turkey.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is supporting an effort to build a monument in Washington, D.C. for Native American veterans. Native organizations and tribes across the country are backing the project. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, a resolution in favor of the memorial was passed last month at the AFN annual convention.
If you've been to the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial in Washington, D.C., it's likely you've also seen a bronze sculpture of three soldiers that stands nearby.
A soldier in the middle represents the Caucasian. The soldier on the right represents the African American. And the soldier on the left wearing the boonie cap is commonly referred to as the Hispanic or Latino.
Stephen Bowers is a member of the Seminole Tribe of Florida. He's also a Vietnam veteran. Last month, Bowers was in Alaska to garner support for the American Indian Veterans Memorial Initiative.
Our own research tells us the American Indian, Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian serve more per capita than any other ethnic group in the whole country, but we're not recognized.
During their annual convention, the Alaska Federation of Natives passed a resolution in support of the initiative. Earlier this year, Hawaii Democrat Senator Brian Schatz introduced a bill to reauthorize construction of a memorial on the National Mall. In the House, Oklahoma Republican Mark Wayne Mullen introduced similar legislation. Both bills have been referred to committees, but they haven't gone anywhere since. Stephen Bowers says that's nothing new.
There have been six other attempts to put some type of recognition in Washington, D.C.
Bowers says more than 130 tribes nationwide support the initiative. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
In November 1991, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Education Foundation was officially incorporated to provide scholarships and promote cultural heritage. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And you are tuned to KTOO News, and my first three guests are in the studio with me, and they are here to talk about Seussical the Musical. And I understand there's performances this weekend. I'll just let you introduce yourselves.
I'm Maggie Comstock.
I'm Chris Clark.
And I'm Karen Allen.
And Karen, I know that you're one of the directors, and as well as...
I co-direct along with Cinnamon Simpson, who founded Theater at Latitude 58.
Great. Tell me about that theater, because I'm not familiar with it.
We've been around for 2 years. This is our, I think, fifth production. We've done Sunshine, Once Upon a Mattress, The Best Christmas Pageant Ever, and Alice's Adventures in Wonderland since we were founded. And our theater was founded by Cinnamon Simpson, as I said, as a theater where families could perform together. In this show, for example, we have three generations of one family and two generations of several others. We have cousins and siblings. We have nieces and nephews. And we have a whole bunch of families all working together.
So how many people are in this production?
46, I think.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. And now this is tell me a little bit about the production. First of all, when and where will it be?
We will be performing Saturday at 7 p.m. and Friday at 7 p.m., and matinees on Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m.
And the production itself, now, does this include, is this the full-on production with costume, set, choreography, orchestra, everything?
We have a little of everything. Opera to Go provided our vocal direction and our orchestra. The fabulous Chris Clark here, along with Angela Smith, produced our wonderful costumes.
Oh, wow. And so what are you doing in it? Maggie and Chris, what are you doing in it?
I play the Sour Kangaroo.
And you're a singer?
Oh, yeah.
And do you dance as well?
Yep.
And she wears ears.
Oh, lovely. And Maggie, what
I play Gertrude McFuzz and the mayor's wife, depending on which night you come.
Okay. So I know it's based on Dr. Seuss's books. Is there a story or is it a series of stories?
It is a series of interconnected stories. It has one major plot that centers around Horton the elephant. And he finds his hooves and he gets their clover, but he gets stolen. And then he gets socked with an egg. The Cat in the Hat is there. He's our host and MC. And we have... I think 28 different Dr. Seuss books mixed in there somewhere, but it is one coherent plot.
So in this production, who all was involved in putting it together?
We produced it in collaboration with Opera to Go.
Mm-hmm. And who did the costumes? Were
Chris Clark and Angela Smith did our costumes.
And the choreography?
George Watt did our set. And Janice Hurley and Rishi Adan did our choreography.
And who's in the orchestra? Is that a big orchestra, a little orchestra?
I haven't actually heard the full orchestra. Doug Smith is playing the piano, and this is a brutal piano part. Amy Bibb is conducting. And I know we have some reeds, some brass, and some percussion. Mm-hmm. We'll find out tonight.
We have a guitar also. We have, Amy told me yesterday there's a baritone sax, drums, guitar, piano, possibly a clarinet. She wasn't sure about that yet. So, yeah, good compilation of instruments.
Oh, that's great. So I know that this musical was premiered on Broadway in the year 2000, and from what I've heard, it's a pretty lively, rocking musical.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it really sounds like a lot of fun. Was it fun to produce?
Oh, yeah. We have had a very, very good time with this show.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, this would be good for all ages. because
definitely, mm-hmm, yeah,
from children on up. So how long is the musical? How long does it run?
It runs with intermission, just a little more than 2 hours.
And what is the cost, and where do you get tickets?
Tickets are available at Hearthside Books or at the door, and they are $15 for adults and $10 for students and seniors.
Good. So we've been talking about Seussical the Musical with Maggie Comstock, Chris Clark, and Karen Allen. And it's this weekend. There are 4 shows, Friday at 7, Saturday at 2 and 7, and Sunday at 2. And sounds like a really fun thing to do, especially as the weather gets cold and snowy. Might as well go see a musical. Sounds like lots of fun. So thanks for coming in, ladies.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for having us.
The Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 19th of November, 2013. It's the birthday of the poet Sharon Olds, born San Francisco, 1942, grew up in Berkeley as a Hellfire Calvinist, went to Stanford, and then off to Columbia to get her Ph.D. Did not publish her first book of poems until she was a few years shy of 40. Teaches creative writing at NYU, lives on the Upper West Side of New York. Sharon Olds, who said, "I'm not asking a poem to carry a lot of rocks in its pockets, just being an ordinary observer and liver and feeler and letting the experience get through you onto the notebook with the pen, through the arm, out of the body, onto the page without distortion." And it was on this day in 1863, Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address at the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, 4.5 months after the terrible battle, on a foggy, cold morning. The president arrived about 10 o'clock. Around noon, the sun came out. The crowds were gathered on a hill overlooking the battlefield. A band played. A local preacher gave a long prayer, and the headline orator, Edward Everett, spoke for more than 2 hours, describing the battle in great detail, bringing the audience to tears more than once. And when he was finished, the president stood up and spoke. His speech, just over 2 minutes long, less than 300 words, only 10 sentences, so brief, in fact, that many of the 15,000 people who were there didn't even realize that he had spoken, because a photographer setting up his camera distracted them. But the next day, Edward Everett told Lincoln, "I wish that I could flatter myself that I had come as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes. 5 different manuscript copies of the Gettysburg Address remain, all of them slightly different. One copy was signed and dated by Lincoln, and that is the one accepted as the official version. Here's a poem for today by Mark Halliday, Historic Shirt. Ran into Alyssa and Todd, and Alyssa said, "I like your shirt." And I laughed, because it's obviously very old. And she said, "But it looks so soft and comfortable." And I agreed, and Alyssa said, "And that little heart is so sweet," referring to the red velvet heart sewn on the left shoulder. So I said, "There's a lot of history in that," and then had to explain that my first wife sewed the heart on this shirt for her boyfriend before me. And Alyssa said, "Wow, that seems symbolic of something." And Todd laughed, and I said, "It probably means that I refuse to let go of any trace of the past." And Alyssa said, "Or maybe it means you refuse to be oppressed by the past." And I said, that sounds good. And Todd sort of half smiled. And Alyssa said, you accept the past so it can't then turn around and bite you. And for a half second, this idea sparkled alarmingly in the air. And then we all smiled in order to let the scene end. And Alyssa walked away arm in arm with her new husband to go on making the life that would be their past together. Historic Shirt by Mark Halliday from Threshophobe, published by the University of Chicago Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, with assistance by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Guest on a Juno afternoon is Tom Bryce. Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Good, and welcome to the radio studio. And Tom is here to discuss Operation Christmas Child. So tell us about this program and give us a little background.
A little bit of background. First of all, this is the 20th year of Operation Christmas Child and the shoebox efforts. Americans in this program have collected over 100 million shoeboxes and delivered them throughout the world for the past 20 years. It's quite the effort. While there's a lot of international relief organizations out there that are focused on food and housing and those important things and medicine, this is a relief effort by Samaritan's Purse to focus on the kids and to give them a little bit of hope. You can do that by packing a shoebox and getting it to Chapel by the Lake by Sunday.
Okay, and that's Sunday, this Sunday.
Yep.
And then from there, you will pack them up and send them off?
Absolutely. Sunday is the main packing day. While we'll still take boxes on Monday, we'd prefer to have everything in by Sunday. And all you do, it's real simple. You know, you get gifts for either a boy or a girl, either 3 or 4 years old, 5 years old, 7, 8 years old, even up into the low teens. You pack a shoebox and, you know, with hard candies, with gifts, new gifts, nothing. We don't want new or used stuff, but toothbrushes, combs,
something that'll fit in the shoebox.
It fit in the shoebox. One of the things that we've been pushing and that I've been putting into my shoeboxes this year has been, you know, eating utensils, a spork, right? A nice cup, a camping bowl, those types of things that kids maybe in a war-torn area of the world or in a third world nation where there's not a lot of those types of utensils around, you know, they might find some real use out of. There's another thing people like to use, which are getting the plastic boxes or plastic Rubbermaid boxes or even fishing boxes and that kind of stuff. And then they use that as the container versus, say, a shoebox. But we're looking for the containers that are roughly that dimension of a regular size shoebox.
So what you're asking for people is to get a box of some
mm-hmm.
sort and then fill it with what they think a child would like. Now, is that labeled for a certain age?
Yes, it is. Generally, there's three age groups that we're shooting for, young teens, like between 11, 12, up to about 14, 10, 11, 8, 9 to 10 and 11, and then even younger kids for, you know, 7, 8, down to like 3 or 4 years old. And then, obviously, gender specific. So.
And where will these Juno shoeboxes go?
Well, the process is at Chapel by the Lake, we gather shoeboxes not just from the Juno community. I mean, we've got churches participating, businesses participating, various organizations across the community participating. We bring them to Juno. AML, who's been a wonderful partner in this effort, hats off to Susan Ashton over there. They get them down to Seattle. From Seattle, they hit California, where they are distributed out to the various third world nations, that kind of stuff. You know, we get the shoe boxes in from AML brings a whole lot, but Alaska Seaplanes and Carl Ramseth over there has been really helpful. Tyler Rentals have been really helpful in terms of providing assistance, you know, with the equipment. So we bring them in, we count them up, pack them in cartons, and that's the big day on Sunday, and send them south before Thanksgiving.
If people want to bring them in during the week, can they do that?
The collection center is open generally between 9 and 5 for the rest of this week over at Chapel by the Lake. You'll see big signs. Wednesday will be open until about 7 in the evening. So if you're coming in after work tomorrow, that's a good time to drop off. Then Saturday and Sunday we'll be taking boxes between 1 and 3. Now, if anybody is so inclined and wants to help count boxes and pack boxes, about 12:30 Sunday afternoon we'll get started and there will be a nice lunch provided.
How many boxes do you usually get?
Well, we've been getting between 2,200 and 2,400 every year for Southeast Alaska, and that's actually been very good. You know, relative to, say, and I don't want to get in too much trouble, but don't want to brag against Anchorage and Fairbanks, but generally proportionate to our
per capita,
we do much better.
That's great.
That being said, it's an effort to help, you know, kids. It's not a competition. But this year, Ketchikan's kind of laid down a challenge, and they've upped their boxes by about 20%. So, you know, it'd be really nice to see the Juno community meet that challenge and bring our box contributions up by about 20% too.
Yeah. What a wonderful program. How long have you been involved in this?
Well, I got started packing shoe boxes with my kids when they were 7 and 8.
Oh, great thing to do with your kids.
Absolutely. It's a good way to talk to them about getting things for other kids, talking about, you know, what's happening in the world, that not everybody is as safe and secure as we are here in Alaska or in Juneau, not that we don't have needs here. But there are some places in this world where it can be really tough for a child. And then, you know, talking to them about those issues, then talking about giving, philanthropy, you know, and those types of things. It's really a wonderful time. So I've been doing this about 8 years, I think, now, in one form or another.
Great. So if people want more information, what can they do?
A couple of different things. I would suggest they Google Operation Christmas Child, and it comes up shoe boxes.
And will that give you some ideas?
That will give you some ideas. If you don't want to pack your own shoebox, you can actually go on the internet and pack a shoebox on the net that they put together and ship for you. You can download pictures and cards and letters to individuals for the thing as well. That's another way that people can participate also.
And is there a phone number that they
call? Yes, if people have questions locally, they can call me, Tom Bryce, at 321-5358. And we've got supplies. We've got all the labels. We've got extra shoe boxes.
Good.
We've got, you know, rubber bands, everything that they need to, you know, to go out and to put something together.
Okay, so I've been talking to Tom Bryce about Operation Christmas Child here in Juneau, and thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And the time is about 3:27. Thanks for joining us here on a Juneau afternoon. Today is World Toilet Day, and Sue Belita is here in the studio to tell us about it. Hi, Sue.
Good afternoon.
And thanks for coming in. I know World Toilet Day, a few people might chuckle over that, but I know it's a really serious topic, and I'd like you to just tell us why toilets are so important throughout the world.
Well, it is kind of amazing. There's so many holidays, you know, and it's just hard to find an appropriate card for World Toilet Day. But it is a very particular day. There's been a World Toilet Day on November 19th for several years. This is the first year that it's been recognized by the United Nations as something that really matters, that has a lot of implications. You know, after you get past the giggles, it is a very, very serious topic. In fact, billions of people, 2.5 billion people in the world, do not have safe and adequate access to a bathroom. And for us who, you know, we take it so for granted until something goes wrong with our plumbing that, you know, you'll just get up in the morning and you have bathrooms, maybe one, two, or three in your house. You go shopping, you can go to Costco, you can go to Walmart, you can go to Joann's, you can go in the mall. They're everywhere we go, in a restaurant or whatever, we have availability. We have, and sometimes we get frustrated because we go into a public restroom and there's no toilet paper. Well, you know, that's minor compared to really the social implications, the health implications, the education implications that not really having access to a toilet has worldwide.
So what are some of those health implications and social implications?
700,000 children die every year because of diarrhea, and that is usually a waterborne. They've got bad water, or puddles of feces and urine are collected and get walked through, and they become ill through that. And so 700,000 is a big number. That's 2,000 children every single day. Diarrhea-borne illnesses kill 2,000 children every single day, and it's a preventable disease. It has those sort of implications. These are things that we can affect. In addition, there are some real other dynamics in terms of safety, especially for women. Women often will wait until night because they don't want to be seen going to the bathroom. And so as they go and look for a place to go to the bathroom, they are very frequently sexually assaulted because they're alone, they're vulnerable, it's dark. So it is not a safe thing to have to go find a place to go to the bathroom. Young women, when they hit puberty and begin having their monthly period, oftentimes they have to drop out of school because they don't have access to a bathroom facility to be able to manage that throughout the day. So it has education implications. It has health implications. In all of that then moves forward into real economic implications. If you have someone with a better education, they can get a better job and make better money. So it's a whole cycle of things that are connected to just having a bathroom.
What are people doing to alleviate this problem, and who's doing it?
One of the primary sponsors of World Toilet Day has been WaterAid.org. WaterAid is an organization that's been working regularly and a long time on this issue. And one of the great things, a lot of times I come, this is sort of my banner-waving moment of just saying, hey, be aware that you are really blessed by being able to have access to a bathroom and think about those who don't. This year, there's a very particular fundraiser on December 3rd. It's called Giving Tuesday. And if you go to WaterAid.org, there'll be more information about that. But they have a $50,000 grant that they will match your donation penny for penny to be able to provide clean water, toileting facilities, and other water-related aid to a variety of locations. And one of the things that's interesting, I was talking about it today, and while we often make that focus someplace other, we know that honey buckets are in use in Western Alaska. And so, you know, toileting and those kinds of access and aid things also have implications for us here.
How did you get involved with this?
Do you know, I really wish I could tell you. I think I came across it. And again, it's one of those things that makes you giggle at first, that there's a World Toilet Day. And then after you start reading about it, quite honestly, I became pretty passionate about it. And so I usually write like newsletter articles about it. And, you know, I was very tempted on Douglas Highway. There was a toilet on the side of the road that said free. And, oh, I was so tempted just to pick it up so that we could throw change in it, you know, or collect change or something for that. But I really don't know what that impetus was. I just know that that moment happened, and it started out, I think, as a giggle, and I hope it starts out for most people as a giggle. And at, on WaterAid.org, if you go onto that, there's a, now a YouTube video of an animated toilet singing. So there's Louie the Loo. You've got that video, so we'll be able to hear a little bit of Louie the Loo's song. So, you know, there is a lightheartedness to it that you really can't celebrate World Toilet Day without smiling. And really what that does then is lead us to greater smiles in terms of real health and economic issues.
So for you, this is just entirely volunteer effort. What do you do in real life?
In real life, I'm pastor at Resurrection Lutheran Church.
Oh, good. And is there anything particular here in Juneau that we're going to be doing, or just awareness?
You know, I think it's just awareness. I don't have anything particularly planned. This may become one of those things. As I say, I've come for several years here to a Juneau afternoon to raise it as awareness. Now, here is the United Nations saying, well, we're going to officially recognize this as a day. I think it might be, if you'll excuse me, a movement that grows.
Good one. And also, as you mentioned, on December 3rd, there will be a fundraising activity on the WaterAid.
Yes, if you go to WaterAid.org on that Tuesday and donate on their website, that's how you would get the matching funds.
Okay, I've been talking with Sue Belita about World Toilet Day, which is today, November 19th.
Woo-hoo.
And thank you so much for doing this and letting us know about this. And now I'm going to play a song by Louie the Loo, The Singing Toilet.
Enjoy.
I am your toilet, so how do you do? I take away your wee and the odd number two. For a quiet moment, I'll always be there, bringing you troubles. You don't even have to care. Time you have to do a poo or a wee. Thank the sanitary saints that you have me. When you think of all the things that I do, it's time to say thanks to your loo. La 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 la.
Okay, that was Louie the Loo, and you are tuned to KTOO News, and I am pleased to be talking to Tom Robinault, and he's from the Perseverance Theater's Treasure Island.
Yes, ma'am.
And thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And so I have to tell you, I went to a sold-out performance of Treasure Island on Saturday, and it was a wonderful performance. And as always, the acting was superb.
Great.
And so can you just tell us a little bit about the play?
Yeah, so the play story follows a story of a young boy named Jim Hawkins. And Jim Hawkins, who has lost his father, and he takes over running his father's inn for the family. And while he's at the inn, running the inn, a pirate comes along who is running away from a group of pirates. It's Captain Flint's crew. And he stays at the inn with Jim Hawkins, and the rest of the pirates follow and track him down, and they find this guy at the inn. Well, what he's got is he has his treasure map, and it's this map that has is a treasure map that shows the location of where Captain Flint's treasure is. And so before the character Billy Bones is that is my character,
mm-hmm.
yes, and he passes away of a heart attack in the first scene, that he gives it to Jim Hawkins. And so right before the pirates get it away from Jim Hawkins comes a whole group of I guess you could call it the local militia, which is Squire Trelawney, that's another character I play, and Dr. Livesey. And what happens is Squire Trelawney, they chase the pirates away. Squire Trelawney gets a map and then decides he's going to go and find the treasure with Jim Hawkins and Dr. Livesey. And at the same time, the pirates find their way onto the ship and all sorts of mayhem follows.
Okay, that sets the scene for us and gets people into the action there. So I was interested in the character Aaron Aquino Abella, mm-hmm. and he plays Jim Hawkins, who is a 14-year-old boy, but he's not 14.
No, I think he's 18 years old,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
And he's remarkable.
Yeah, he's great.
He's and I was curious if he's got some future in acting or...
Well, actually, he's been working on looking at monologues, and he's going to work with Shona Strasser, who's the education director at Perseverance, and he's going to work on a Shakespeare monologue. Yeah, he's going to go out there and he's going to audition for some schools. I think he took a year off before he went out for schools, but there is definitely, I see a bright future in his career.
So what I learned from reading the program, and I thought this was really interesting, that this play is it's based on the book by Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island. And what interested me was he didn't even begin writing until he was after 30.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would think of a writer of that caliber, you know, that's all they knew that they wanted to do.
Right. And it's a thing, I guess part of that has to do with actually living a life before you start writing, you know, having experiences and having adult experiences before you start writing, that it's something that actually comes out of you later on, which I think is really interesting. And I think that's what makes his story so rich.
I think so, too. And the way it was explained was that when he was 30, he married a widow who had a child, a son. And so he told his stepson stories. And then one day his stepson said, "Hey, why don't you write that down?"
Right.
Which is kind of funny. But also what I learned from the program was that the whole pirate stereotype and the pirate language, you know, the peg leg, the parrot, the, you know, yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum, that all comes from Treasure Island.
It does. The stereotypical pirate that we think of with the eye patch and the peg leg and the parrot on the shoulder, that was actually created by Robert Louis Stevenson, yes. And so what people come to know as pirates and what they envision in their head actually came from his writing.
Yeah, and that book was written in the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
And the director, Anita Maynard Losh, is that how you say it?
Yes, it is.
She used to be at Perseverance and left, I think, about 10 years ago and is back to direct this play.
Yeah, she came back from the arena stage. That's where she went, which is in D.C. It's a very big stage. She went to go join Molly Smith, who I believe is the big founder of Perseverance Theater. And then she came all the way back to direct the play, and I have a feeling this isn't the last time she does it. So, yeah, it was a great time working with her. She's an expert at what she does, and she really got us involved into what the characters are and who they really are, rather than playing just stereotypical pirates, but actually playing a full-bodied character out there with actual feeling and emotion.
I'm talking to Tom Robinall here, And we're talking about the Perseverance Play Treasure Island. I know that there's performances this weekend, and I think the next 2 weekends.
There is for the next 3 weeks.
And I don't know, do you know about the Dress Up Like a Pirate night?
Yes, that is not this Wednesday, but I believe the next Wednesday. But before that, we have a special event on November 22nd. That's this Friday, and it's called Beer Friday, and it's at the Alaskan Brewing Company. For people who have purchased tickets, audience members of the November 22nd show, and if you haven't bought tickets, it'd be a great day to buy tickets for November 22nd, that Friday, because there's a free tasting of Alaska seasonal beers and rough draft beers before the show, and that starts at 6 o'clock in the Phoenix before the show. So it's a good way to go taste some, free beer. Just tastings, by the way, but just taste some free beers, some of their new stuff, and then come and enjoy the show.
That's great.
Yeah.
So it's a great action play. I highly recommend it. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes long, and I think that's with the intermission.
Yes.
And you're safe to bring your kids. I know that there were a number of children in the theater, and I didn't hear a peep out of them.
Yeah, I think that's the great thing about this play is that it really can capture its good. It really is fun for the whole family. And when we say fun for the whole family, I guess more like entertainment for the whole family, where it grabs the kids that are even the little ones all the way up to the adults, because the language is strong enough that it would grab an adult. Like the relationship between Jim Hawkins and Long John Silver, it grabs an adult's attention. And I think, a child will pick up the main storyline, especially with all the sword fighting and all the action going on. It definitely grabs their attention. We really haven't had any problems with kids like yelling. I think the other day we actually had a little kitten, which they don't normally allow, but this child in a lady's lap, and didn't hear a peep from it for the whole 2 hours, which is amazing.
I know, especially with that kind of 19th century conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So before you go, can you just give us a few lines of pirate talk?
I can. Let's see. How about this? Flint's map, the great Captain Flint, and it's pointing straight to hundreds of thousands, boy. Hundreds of thousands in gold and silver and little trinkets made of pearls.
That's great. Thanks, Tom, for coming in. And so, Perseverance Theater, Treasure Island.
Treasure Island for the next 3 weekends. Yeah. Treasure Island.
Come and see it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services in the Jordan Creek Center. Northern Audiology offers diagnostic medical hearing expertise and digital technology hearing instruments. 789-6780.
You've got brains in your head and feet in your shoes, so steer yourself any direction you choose.
Theater at Latitude 58 and Opera to Go presents Seussical the Musical. Based on the stories of Dr. Seuss, Seussical takes you on a musical ride with Fortune the Elephant, the Planet of Pooh, Gertrude McBuzz, and the Cat in the Hat, and more.
Performances are November 22nd, 23rd, and 24th at the Thunder Mountain High School Auditorium. Friday and Saturday night shows are at 7 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday matinees are at 2. Tickets are available from Hearthside Books and at the door.
I remember it all as though it were yesterday. The adventure of my life that changed me from a boy to a man and is still changing me and will never stop. Join me, Jim Hawkins, and my friends as we travel to Skeleton Island. Along the way, we'll meet mutineers, madmen, and the most famous pirate of all, Long John Silver.
Treasure Island, now playing at Perseverance Theater through December 8th. This is one you won't want to miss. More information can be found online at perseverancetheater.org or by calling 463-TIXS.
And remember, dead men tell no tales.
This is Bird Note. Sharp, insistent cries signal the presence of one of North America's most beautiful birds of prey, a red-shouldered hawk. The hawk calls again, yet remains unseen. No doubt perched within a nearby stand of trees, just beyond the river's edge. A favorite milieu for this somewhat secretive raptor. Here it is at last, gliding out of the woods to perch on a branch overlooking the river. There's no mistaking this striking hawk for any other. The front of its body glows bright chestnut, the back boldly spangled black and white, the shoulders that same blazing chestnut. Roughly crow-sized, Red-shouldered hawks are found throughout the eastern U.S., retreating from the north in winter. Distinctive populations inhabit Florida and California west of the Sierra Nevada, with a diet ranging from chipmunks and voles to snakes, frogs, and crayfish. This versatile hawk may hunt by pouncing on prey in the forest, sprinting low across an open field, or even snatching a frog or snake right from the water's surface. So, when you're in the right neck of the woods, keep an ear out for an emphatic and your eyes peeled for a gorgeous red-shouldered hawk. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And my last guests in the studio are students from Thunder Mountain High School. Welcome, everybody. And also Annie James, who's a teacher at Thunder Mountain High School. And I'll let them all introduce themselves. And could you also tell us what grade you're in?
Hi, my name is Corbin. I am a senior at Thunder Mountain.
Hi, I'm Patrick, and I'm also a senior at Thunder Mountain.
I'm Chloe, and I'm a senior at Thunder Mountain.
Okay, we got all seniors here. And they're here to talk about AVID, which is stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination. And so I don't know who wants to answer this, but what is AVID? What is this program?
I'll start. I'm Annie James, and I teach at Thunder Mountain High School. I teach English and AVID. And AVID is a program that was brought to our district as another layer of educational support for students for college readiness skills and career search skills. So students who are in the AVID program are basically making a pretty serious commitment to their future. They're looking at future goals, and they're researching their careers and colleges.
Good. And let me ask, one of you, I don't know who wants to answer this question, but why did you choose to take AVID in ninth grade?
Okay, I'll answer. I'm Corbin. I actually came into AVID my 10th grade year. I'm different from my two peers. My teacher, Ms. Strains, she saw potential in me, and she really wanted me to join AVID. So, like, I joined, and so far I've really liked it. And, yeah, that's why I joined.
And how about you, Patrick?
The way I joined wasn't really the traditional way. Because usually when you first join AVID, you first go through, like, an interview process in which they see how you'd fit with the program and if you're compatible with it. With me, to be honest, in ninth grade, I was trying to get out of a gym class, and they suggested AVID to me as a potential class to fill that
way
in.
To get out of gym class.
Yeah. So I chose AVID, and it really has helped, even though I didn't know what it was at the time, because it was the very first year that it was offered. It's been a tremendous amount of help to me. And
you, Chloe, why did you choose to take AVID?
Ms. James came in to my principal's office in the eighth grade and interviewed me and asked me if I wanted to be a part of AVID.
So you're the traditional one who starts in ninth grade and goes through senior year.
Yeah.
And why did you continue through your senior year?
I continued through my senior year because I guess I was constantly putting more and more of myself into the class. And every year I'd grow as a person, and it just kind of excited me to see what would happen the next year and how I would grow as a person the next year.
Was that your choice to continue in the program?
Yes, I've always had an option to switch out or take a different class.
And how about you, Patrick or Corbin? Why did you continue?
I definitely agree with Chloe's statement about AVID helping me grow as a person. Before the AVID program, I was sort of, I was the kind of student that went straight from school and straight home, and I didn't really have anything in between but academics, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I wasn't exploring my options. With AVID, I'd like to say that I became so much more of a well-rounded person. I went out and got jobs. I'm joining extracurricular activities. I'm taking higher level classes, and it's definitely filled me in on those areas that before I never would have thought that I'd go explore. So yeah.
And I agree as well. I mean, since joining AVID, I've seen a tremendous growth in my personal and academic.
What kind of skills have you learned from AVID?
Actually, I was a really unorganized person before I joined AVID, and since I've joined AVID, I've become a lot more organized, which has helped me in more than just academics, as well as, like, my, you know, going to work and doing a whole bunch of other stuff, like extracurricular activities. I've gotten all that organized.
Yeah, organization is really important. How about you, Patrick?
With most other classes, you find that, you know, after a year or two, you forget some of the things that you were learning or even the subject of the class entirely. But with AVID, almost every single thing that I've learned, I've taken with me to real life, because we learn things like making cover letters, making resumes, applying for jobs, going through the job interview process, and, you know, most importantly, all the college process that we're all going through right now.
Does AVID specifically teach you these skills and give you these tools? Is that part of the program?
Yeah. It's a college preparatory class, but it's at the same time more than that. It doesn't focus strictly on college. It also focuses on life after college, like I said before, jobs and such.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a big component of the AVID program is essentially college-ready study skills, and so students will leave high school and be fully prepared to be successful in college. That is our goal. And, as Patrick stated, their future as well beyond college. So
seems like that would be a good goal for every student.
AVID would be great for every student, I will say that.
Chloe, what kind of skills and tools have you picked up through the program?
I think that in class I've learned how to be a better student, but also leaving the classroom I've learned how to reach out to other peers and teach them what I have learned and take it out into my community and become not only a better school person, but become a better person to my community.
How many students are in this program?
AVID's been going for 4 years. We started out with our first class, one class in both high schools, actually all three high schools. We had a class, and then both middle schools had one class. And now we have grown to where in our two major high schools, we have four classes of AVID in each one of those high schools. And in the middle schools, both seventh and eighth grade classes. So we've grown quite a bit. And there's a component of AVID that is actually in elementary, too. So we have one elementary school that has an AVID class.
So I guess you could say it's been a success.
Yes, definitely.
So what is the tutorial? Somebody want to answer that one?
Okay, so a tutorial is basically something, you fill out these things called tutorial request forms, and you basically just present a question that you have from a class that you just couldn't get on your own or you couldn't, like, get from your peers. You present it to a group of your AVID peers as well as a tutor, and they basically just ask you questions and they bring you to the answer. Instead of just telling you the answer outright, they ask you questions, and it basically just brings yourself to the question.
And that helps with the learning.
Oh, yeah, like, definitely. Like, without tutorial request forms, I honestly, I don't know. Like,
it makes you think?
Yeah, it does, definitely. It's always nice.
Always a good thing.
Yeah.
I'll ask Chloe this. What's it like to be with the same group of students for 4 years?
I think it has its ups and downs. When you're with the same people for 4 years, you have the moments when you just want to maybe say something you shouldn't. But that's, I think, what makes it special, is that you're growing close as a family and you're becoming so comfortable with each other that you can support them and tell them what they need to hear.
And you kind of got to get along and be nice because they're not gone anywhere, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, Patrick, where are you plan to go to college?
I'm planning to go to University of Anchorage.
And what do you think you'll be studying there?
I'm interested in pursuing a psychology major.
Excellent. How about you, Corbin?
I'm also going to be attending the University of Anchorage. I want to be studying pharmaceutical engineering.
Wow.
Yeah.
Good. And Chloe?
I have recently applied to Cottey College. I haven't heard back yet, but I'm hoping it's going to be good. And I'm thinking about going for their business, bachelor's in business, and then later go on to become a geriatrician.
So what, for the kids who aren't in AVID, do they sometimes look to you guys to find out about how to plan for college and career?
Yeah, actually, since, like, they know that we're in AVID, a lot of students know to, like, come to us, ask for questions about, like, colleges, and I've actually helped a lot of my peers about just, you know, either pointing them to Ms. Jane's direction, or I can give them the answer myself from the things I've learned in AVID.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming in and explaining the AVID program.
Well, thank you very much for having us. Yes.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
And, yeah, I wish you good luck, all of you.
Hey,
you too.
Oh.
That's it for today's Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining me. Thanks to all the guests today and to Jeff Brown for producing the program. And if you want to listen to any of the interviews on Juno Afternoon, you can just go to the KTOO.org website. Please join us tomorrow at 3 p.m. for a Juno Afternoon. Our host will be Lisa Fu. We'll learn about Orca ski and snowboard season. Eric Boras from Trail Mix about this Saturday's dinner and auction. Edie Rodewald and Liz Weber will highlight Thursday's Great American Smokeout, and we'll find out about Rotaract's Christmas Dinner Box Project. That Writer's Almanac, music, and more tomorrow at 3 on KTOO FM. And the weather tonight is cloudy, scattered snow showers, lows 5 to 13. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, scattered snow showers, highs 18 to 23.
Obamacare is to President Obama as Katrina was to President Bush.
At least as far as poll numbers go.
Today is Tuesday, November 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.